This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
The world is on the brink. Wars, contentious elections, disinformation spreading at warp speed, and Donald Trump at the center of all of it. But what does it mean for the rest of us? Every week on Pod Save the World, Tommy Vietor and I cut through the noise to explain how global power is shifting. No jargon, no homework, just clear, honest conversations about what's happening and why it matters. From breaking news to long simmering international conflicts, we dissect it all with critical analysis and some jokes that will surely embarrass our children one day. Tune in to Pod Save the World every Wednesday, wherever you get your podcasts, or catch it on YouTube.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hi, Lucy here. Just before we get started, I want to let you know about another BBC Radio 4 podcast series that I think you'd really like. It's called You're Dead to Me, and it's hosted by Greg Jenner.
You're Dead to Me is a comedy show that takes history seriously. My name's Greg Jenner. I'm a public historian, and every episode I pair up a top historian with a top comedian for a funny, fascinating chat about something different from global history each time. We chat for about 55 minutes. You'll learn a lot, you'll laugh a lot, and it's plenty of fun. So why not check it out?
Thanks, Greg. Well, if you want to discover the many, many amazing episodes available, you can search for You're Dead to Me on BBC Sounds. Now let's get started.
This is Lady Killers, where history meets true crime, from BBC Radio 4, with me, Lucy Worsley. Life among the workers of Victorian England was tough. It was repetitive. It was grinding. It was often dirty. And with children to feed, women often had to rely upon husbands to earn the money to survive. If a husband died, and death was very much more part of life then, it wasn't uncommon for a woman to remarry quickly to ensure that she and her children could eat. And the very existence of these children could be a problem, a drain on resources. Some took rather desperate measures.
I saw the prisoner in July. I went to engage her to attend a smallpox patient. She did not take the engagement, stating that she could not go, that she had a boy she could not leave. She applied for an order to put him in the workhouse. I said I could not give him an order unless she went with him. She said it was a great hardship that she should be taxed to keep the boy when she had the opportunity of getting a respectable lodger. I said, I suppose you're going to be married to Mr. Mann. She said it might be so, but the boy was in the way. She said it may not make much matter. She would not be troubled long. He will go like all the rest of the Cotton family. I said, you don't mean to tell me this fine, healthy little fellow's going to die. I think the reply was, he would not get up. I thought she meant he would not grow up to manhood.
Welcome back to Lady Killers, the programme that mixes true crime and history with a feminist twist. We're taking a look at the wild and unthinkable crimes apparently committed by different murderesses from Britain, North America and beyond. And with me here in the studio is Alexandra Wilson, a barrister who's specialised in criminal and family law, author of the book about race and class in the justice system. Alex will walk us through the legal implications of today's case. And we'll be joined by our resident historian, Rosalind Crone, from the Open University. So let's get stuck into the case of Mary Ann Cotton in the northeast of England. Known as Britain's first female serial killer, she's thought to have killed up to 17 people, though some say 21. These are people ranging from her lodgers, to her lovers, to her stepchildren and several husbands. Why? Well, to move on up in the world, collecting financial benefits along the way, including payouts from life insurance. Is Mary Ann Cotton. We meet her aged 41, working as a nurse. It's 1872. She now has three dead husbands, one abandoned husband, numerous dead children, and one living stepchild who lives with her in this miner's village in the northeast. These villages are scattered throughout the County Durham countryside. They're gathered around coal pits. Conditions here are harsh. Work down the mines is dangerous, but the mine was the centre of the whole community. Mary Ann has recently lost her husband, Frederick Cotton. Though she's still responsible for his son, Charles Edward Cotton, she's also having an affair with the local tax collector, a man called Mr. Mann or Mr. Quick Manning. He's known by both names. And she's pregnant, presumably with his child. That's quite a family history, isn't it, Alex?
I would be worried about representing her in front of a jury, let's put it that way. I think it doesn't look good that she's already got so many dead husbands and children. That is a concern.
It gets worse than that. It looks like a new and lucrative marriage is in the offing with Mr. Quick Manning. But there's an impediment here. The little boy. I worry that Charles Edward Cotton might not be long for this world.
Some days later, on the Friday following, the 12th, I saw the prisoner standing against the upright of her own street door. She appeared to be in trouble. I asked her what was the matter. She said, "My boy's dead." I expressed my surprise, and she invited me to go in. I did not go in. I went and told the police at once.
Roz and I have travelled to the former home of Mary Ann Cotton. That conversation happened right where I am, in this little house, which is number 13 Front Street, in the village of West Auckland, in County Durham, in the northeast of England. And Thomas Riley, whose voice you heard, was a grocer. And importantly, he also happened to be one of the people in charge of poor relief for this village. And, as you heard, Mary Ann Cotton there was asking him if she could put her stepson Charles into the workhouse. And Thomas Riley had said no, she couldn't. So that's why, when that little boy died, Thomas Riley remembered this conversation. He remembered that Mary Ann Cotton had said, well, if the boy couldn't go into the workhouse, it wouldn't matter because he wasn't going to live long anyway. And he'd been a fine, healthy boy. What was all that about? That's very suspicious. That's why Riley started asking questions, which led to a post-mortem into the body of the little boy being carried out. Actually, the post-mortem happened on Mary Ann Cotton's own kitchen table in this house just here. And then the whole thing was investigated at an inquest that took place in this pub right next door. But this post-mortem was inconclusive. It wasn't done terribly well, it was rushed. And Riley, he was a bit of a hero, actually. He went on pushing. Difficult to do in a closed community like this one, but he wanted that boy's body re-examined. Now, Mary Ann Cotton's house today, well, it's a desirable residence. It's three stories high. It's a cute little place. It's opposite an antique shop and next to a tea room. But what was this street like in the 1870s, Roz? I can see you've got your maps there.
So you can see on this map from later in the century how it's dotted with hotels, inns, public houses, post office, the chapel down here. And it was a street that was filled with grocers, drapers, milliners and their families. And the other thing that's interesting to explore, if you look at this, Lucy, and it's absolutely lined with pubs. Look, public house, public house, public house, public house. So the inquest happening in a pub is not unusual because inquests happened in pubs in the 19th century because they are big places that can be used for the administration of local government, justice, etc. That's not unusual in itself. But to choose the pub that's right next door to her house and then to conduct the post-mortem on the kitchen table, and then it's a rushed affair, that post-mortem as well. The jury are gathered, ready, in the pub for the inquest. The coroner's there. And there's Dr. Kilburn in the kitchen in here with the boy on the table, knowing he has to get in there quick to deliver his evidence, what he thinks happened to that boy. So he's rushed. He takes some samples and puts them away, but basically he has a look and he says, yeah, okay, it's probably something like gastroenteritis. Dashes in here and gives his evidence.
This Dr. Kilburn is the local doctor. He's responsible for the post-mortem on poor little Charles Edward Cotton. He later gave evidence in court explaining how he was rushed into giving this initial conclusion.
The coroner's inquest was held within an hour of my examination. I had not time to make a careful examination. I did not test by chemical test before the inquest the contents of the stomach. On the 17th of July, I submitted a portion of the stomach to Rancher's test for poison. The result was
that I found the contents gave indications of arsenical poison. I gave information to Superintendent Henderson, and the prisoner was arrested on the 18th of July.
So thanks to the persistence of that local shopkeeper, Mr. Riley, Mary-Ann Cotton is arrested. Riley requests permission to exhume the body of Charles Edward, which had been buried extremely quickly. And samples from the body get sent for forensic examination to Dr. Thomas Scattergood at Leeds School of Medicine. Alex, could a body be buried that quickly today?
I think it would be highly unlikely. People nowadays would not stand for someone being rushed out of a room to kind of give evidence in the moment after they've just finished their examination. These things take some time and everyone sees the reports beforehand and is given an opportunity to prepare their questions for the expert.
Clearly, the system is not yet what it will become in the 21st century. The pieces aren't in place for that to happen. But Roz, I do get the impression that this is particularly makeshift. And do you think that we can see the influence of Mary-Ann Cotton here? She's sort of pressing the doctor to get this done. Do you think that she just wants to get this finished and move on?
Yeah, of course she does. She's desperate to move on, to become Quick Manning's wife and to have his child to move up in the world.
So the police investigation begins. They talk to the neighbours. They learn about all these mysteriously dead people in Cotton's past. And they learned that she'd recently bought arsenic. Now, that's much more normal than it sounds. Arsenic was easy to buy, and it was used around the house as a cleaning product. Cotton says that she bought the arsenic innocently, and that her stepson may have just consumed it accidentally, by mistake. Do we believe her? We next visit Beamish, the living museum of the North, in County Durham, where the museum's keeper of social history, Rosie Nichols, shows us what seems to be Mary-Ann Cotton's murder weapon.
Rosie, whose teapot is this supposed to be?
It's Mary-Ann Cotton's teapot, allegedly.
This is a tiny teapot. It fits into my two hands. It's got a little spout. It's a dark-coloured ceramic. It's murderously black, I have to say. And the significance is that this is something she would have put the arsenic in, right? You know, I'm imagining, seeing the size of it, that this is tea for one person, so the poison would only go to the person it was supposed to.
Yes, definitely. It seems quite a clever way of doing it, to be honest.
Yeah.
This teapot is for you.
It's potentially a murder weapon. What's the provenance of it? Is there a story about that
makes
sense?
We can link it to West Auckland, actually. So it was donated to us by a GP whose step-grandmother was the wife of a GP in West Auckland who was given it by an older lady.
What do you think of the teapot, Roz? Does it convince you as possibly the actual thing that it purports to be?
Yeah, I think it's certainly possible because tea was a very common way to deliver arsenic to victims. Right, because you needed a hot liquid to dissolve the powder in. Arsenic is very hard to dissolve. And if it goes cold, then it comes back into its powdery form so you can taste it. So you want your tea to remain hot. You need it drunk hot.
Now, Mary-Ann's reason that she gave for having the arsenic in the house, which was undeniable, it was there, was that it was a cleaning product. And that's kind of understandable, isn't it? There were loads of ways in which arsenic was present in Victorian homes.
Yeah, actually, this is a good defence. We know that arsenic is commonly sold at chemists in the 19th century, and it's also in all manner of household things, from wallpaper to clothes to sweets occasionally.
So it's not an implausible line of defence. It's just that in her case, she had so many relatives mysteriously die. It's only with the benefit of time and a lot of detective work that we can reconstruct Mary-Ann Cotton's trail of death wherever she goes. But even in 1872, the police could see that something was up. If Mary-Ann Cotton is telling the truth that the boy had taken the arsenic accidentally, this must have been a real tragedy. Enter Thomas Scattergood, that toxicologist from Leeds School of Medicine who examined samples from Charles Edward's autopsy. Roz has brought along copies of Scattergood's notebooks for me and Alex to have a look at.
Now, he first received the remains of Charles Edward Cotton on the 20th of July, 1872, the stomach, intestines, liver, bowels. And then subsequently, he also examined remains from the other Cotton children, Robert Robson and Frederick Jr., and also Mary Ann's lover, Joseph Natras. Now, most of the information in these notebooks is highly technical, but he also does come to conclusions, both about the quantity of arsenic that was found and also the likelihood of an accident versus the deliberate administration of the poison. He's testing out the theories of the defense case, one of which was, did the boy somehow inhale the arsenic because it was in the green wallpaper in the house? Or did he somehow ingest the arsenic because it was next to or mixed up with the soft soap? In both cases, Thomas Scattergood concluded, no, he didn't. And when he looked at the quantity of arsenic that was found in the remains of these bodies, he thought there's no way this could have been an accident.
So if this were your client, Alex, and you were faced with this piece of evidence, would you be advising her to plead guilty?
I think that although the case seems conclusive at the moment, for me there's still a question mark over the continuity here. It seems as though Mary Ann Cotton had a pretty good defence.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I think that saying that arsenic was in the cupboard and he could have consumed it accidentally, I think that would put some doubt in the jury's mind.
What about motives? Are you allowed to look at people's motivation?
Absolutely, and I think the prosecution would have a whale of a time in this case. I think they'd be trying to get in all of the dead people that, you know, seem to surround Mary Ann Cotton, all of the people that have died within what seems to be quite a short period of time, her ex-partners and everyone she seems to come into contact with.
If she is guilty, then her motivation in this case, the little boy, will have been to get him out of the way because he's definitely an obstacle to her getting this marriage that she wants with Mr. Quick Manning. Have you ever come across cases in contemporary society where that sort of thing has happened, that people have been killed because they're sort of inconvenient?
There probably will be cases like that, but I think the biggest difference between the Victorian era and now is that we have so much more surveillance. We have CCTV, everyone has a camera phone. We have much better forensic analysis nowadays that killing someone, you're a lot more likely to get caught for it. And so I think that if you were inconvenienced, you might think of other ways to get out of that inconvenient situation rather than killing someone, which may have been a bit easier in Victorian times.
Now, another possible motivation here was financial, because Mary Ann Cotton had a history of taking out life insurance policies on her various relatives. Waltz, what was the state of this industry?
The industry was huge. This was because of the high risk of mortality, especially among children in the working classes, and the desire to ensure that people had a proper funeral. Cotton benefited from the death of her first husband, William Mowbray, who had life insurance policy of £35. And along the way, she attempted to take out policies for the other men and children she lived with, sometimes successfully and sometimes not. And that poor little boy, Charles Edward Cotton, her last victim, had been insured for £4.10.
Oof. This strikes me as a particularly Victorian crime because of the arsenic, because of the teapot, because this is an age of domesticity. But crimes by caregivers, they're still with us, aren't they, Alex? What is it like to deal with those cases?
Most of my exposure to those sorts of cases has actually been through my family work. It's been working with parents who are at risk of losing their children and often do lose their children, that social services take them away. And what you realise is that actually a lot of these people are vulnerable. From the outside, we see it as, you know, these cruel people who are motivated by greed. But actually, sometimes these are people who've got many difficulties in their life and have sometimes been victims of crimes themselves. And you do see a much more human element of it when you're sitting in a room one-on-one with these people trying to work out why they've behaved the way they did. So I wonder whether Mary Ann Cotton is similar. I wonder actually if we'd have been there talking to her, whether there was a slightly different motivation for some of these crimes.
At this point, you know, I'm starting to feel a tiny bit sorry for Mary Ann Cotton. But she's also willing to do whatever's necessary to present herself as a loving wife and mother. Newspapers at the time even comment how maternal she is after she nurses her newborn baby, that's her lover, Mr. Quick Manning's baby, in the dock. Is this something you've ever come across, Alex? People playing up various characteristics in order to get sympathy from the system?
Oh, yes.
Oh.
Sometimes it backfires, to be honest. I think sometimes people try to play up perceived vulnerabilities, and actually it just irritates people in the court who have seen it many times before.
I guess I'd like to think, Roz, that today people in court would be more willing to believe that a woman could do something bad than I imagine Victorian juries would have been. Am I being gullible in thinking that?
Yeah, I think you are being a bit gullible, Lucy. If you think back to the Victorian period and the standards that there were for women, women who broke those standards and what was acceptable were almost doubly punished for it. Mm. So I can completely see what Marianne Cotton is trying to do here in trying to use her femininity as a playing card to get off.
So if she is a mother and she's proved to have killed, then that's doubly bad.
Yeah, because it's an offence first against standards of femininity, and then second, it is an offence to kill people. That's wrong too. Mm. So it is a double offence against society.
And Alex, what do you think the importance of sort of the perception of the person in the dock is in a case? Is it as important as we think that it might be from watching crime dramas on the telly?
I actually do think it is, particularly in the Crown Court, where a case like this would have been heard, because you have 12 people, 12 ordinary people who are brought together as a jury. And it's a mix of people that represent society making a decision about their peers. Mm. And barristers do play on that. They, of course, want to appeal to people's emotions and sometimes their stereotypes. And, you know, actually, that can sometimes be in a client's favour.
What are the sort of beliefs that you take into the courtroom about stereotypes that will be operating in the minds of the jury? You have strong views on their perception of race, obviously.
Yeah, juries definitely have their own biases. And I think that they're no different from the biases that are generally seen in society. So yes. I go into a courtroom and I know that even the judge is likely to have a more negative view, for example, of black people than they will of white people, because generally in society, black people are overcriminalized. And so I have to work with that. And the same goes for women. I know that when a woman walks in, they're less likely to be seen as a violent, aggressive person than a man, because we still have those biases that a woman is more likely to be timid. And I think sometimes as lawyers, we play on that.
That's really interesting that the prejudices in the great wide world are sort of boiled down and concentrated in the courtroom, aren't they? All of human life is laid out here.
It really is. And sometimes it really goes against your client. And I think the example of race is one that actually can sometimes make it really difficult. It's trying to undo those biases that people have and stop them making leaps, you know. With women and the assumption that people have that women are likely to be less violent, and you've got a woman who you're representing accused of a violent offence, actually you want to kind of keep that stereotype. And so it's interesting that sometimes we really want to get rid of the stereotypes, which is right, but sometimes those stereotypes can play in our clients' favours.
Despite her attempts to kind of showcase her femininity, her motherhood, Marianne Cotton was found guilty and she was sentenced to hang. But even then, and this is really striking, she didn't give up. She still thought that she was going to get off. She was indomitable. In her last days, she spent her time writing letters to her family and friends, protesting her innocence, asking them to petition the Home Secretary to get her a reprieve from execution.
Sir, I will take it as a great favour if you will call and see me at your earliest convenience. I wish to consult with you about getting me a petition for my life to be spared. You must get the visiting justice's order to come in, and you must tell him what your business is with me. Mr. Fawcett Smith, Bally Durham, and Mr. J.F. Elliott, Elvet Hill Durham, is another. Either of them will give you an order for me. Yours respectfully, M.A. Cotton.
But despite her letters, despite her self-confidence, Marianne Cotton was hanged on the 24th of March, 1873, in Durham County Jail. Alex, do you think that if this case were tried today, there would have been the same outcome?
I don't think so.
Oh, really?
I can't imagine a jury convicting on the basis that Marianne Cotton had bought arsenic and the child had died of arsenic poisoning.
Really?
There's just too much of a gap in between. Oh.
Would it be a problem today that the body had been rushed through autopsy, buried, dug up again, autopsied for the second time? Would that be an issue?
Yeah, there's a huge break in continuity there. And I think that any defence barrister would be delighted that happened. I think they'd be rejoicing that they could suggest that there had been some interference in between the first autopsy and the second one. So I'm not sure that a jury would convict.
And what about her history and her motivation if these were trotted out in court, the history of the mysteriously dead family members and the possible financial motivation of the life insurance? Would that wash?
It depends whether it even was put in front of the jury. So that evidence now is called bad character evidence.
Right.
And you'd want to be making an application if you were the prosecution to get that in front of the jury. But as a defence barrister, you'd be trying to make sure the jury don't find that out. And so you're left with, as I say, that, OK, she had arsenic, which was very common at the time, and he died of arsenic poisoning. But without all of that kind of circumstantial evidence, the case is a little bit more difficult. You can see how someone might have a bit of doubt or couldn't be sure. And it's that high standard that I really do think means that she might have walked free.
Gosh. But then she was only tried for this particular murder, wasn't she? There were lots of other mysterious deaths in her. Well, maybe I'm doing exactly what I'm not supposed to do, which is judging her character rather than the evidence. Now, Alex, when Ros and I were in County Durham, when we visited Marianne Cotton's village of West Auckland, we saw this famous haunted bench. And the story goes that when you're sitting on this bench, you feel a cold wind.
Oh, wow.
Which is a ghost. We felt a cold wind, but we felt it may have generally been just a windy day. Anyway, it shows that she has some local celebrity. But I think it's fair to say that she's not a figure of national celebrity, which I find curious, Ros, given just how many people we think that she killed. What do you think the explanation for that is?
It is curious. I mean, her case made quite a splash in the local newspapers, but it didn't make the same kind of impact in the national press. Why that was is hard to say, isn't it? It's not necessarily that the public were tired of poisonings, because there are still other famous poisoning cases at that time. Could it be, perhaps, that the public was getting tired of women hanging? It was becoming more and more distasteful.
I've got another thought, though, Ros. What if the Victorians didn't want to hear about Marianne Cotton because she reminded them too much of themselves? Let me put it this way. In lots of ways, Marianne Cotton is someone who's taken Victorian values really to heart. She tries to better herself and to be thrifty and to take out life insurance. It's just that she takes it to extremes, doesn't she? I'm really drawn to the argument of criminologist David Wilson. He has suggested that Marianne Cotton is, in fact, the perfect Victorian. She's totally bought into the argument that she needs to better herself, to get richer, to make progress through life. She takes capitalism, if you like, to extremes. I like to think of her as the dark feminine equivalent of someone like an industrial entrepreneur using the means available to try to achieve success. If she hadn't have done that, well, her life would have been life in a mining village. It would have been washing the clothes, cooking the food, no prospect of anything better. Under those circumstances, what would we do? Well, it's goodbye and it's thank you ever so much to Alex Wilson and to Rosalind Crone. Next time on Lady Killers, we're heading to the grim streets of London, where a mother confesses to the killing of three of her own children. And we're visiting the world of the Victorian mental asylum. Don't miss an episode. Just search for Lady Killers on BBC Sounds. Lady Killers is presented by me, Lucy Worsley, and produced by Hannah Fisher. Our resident historian is Rosalind Crone. The music's composed by Asher Nathan, and the sound design is by Chris McLean. The readers are Claire Corbett and Jonathan Keeble. It's a Story Hunter production for BBC Radio 4 and BBC Sounds. Thank you.
world is on the brink. Wars, contentious elections, disinformation spreading at warp speed, and Donald Trump at the center of all of it. But what does it mean for the rest of us? Every week on Pod Save the World, Tommy Vietor and I cut through the noise to explain how global power is shifting. No jargon, no homework, just clear, honest conversations about what's happening and why it matters. From breaking news to long simmering international conflicts, we dissect it all with critical analysis and some jokes that will surely embarrass our children one day. Tune in to Pod Save the World every Wednesday, wherever you get your podcasts, or catch it on YouTube.